It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
I'm Renee Montagne. And David, you've seen, I'm sure, that video of the baby in the park getting snatched by the eagle, you know, the one with 39 million hits.
Yeah, all those hits, and it was totally fake.
Totally fake.
But, I mean, it'd be entertaining for a day, but probably not more than that.
Well, you know, NPR's Netta Ulaby, she, of course, covers social media, and she says that the online world has turned that proverbial 15 minutes of fame into 15 seconds.
So, I just looked up the most popular jokes and pictures people passed around in 2012. I spend way too much time looking at memes on the internet. Yet somehow, I missed a major one. Turns out, last June, a young woman in Texas uploaded a Justin Bieber fan video. She seemed a little unhinged.
Just made a list, all our future kids' names. Bartholomew, Clarence, Steve, and Bryce.
The video was posted to Reddit in a thread called Overly Attached Girlfriend. It picked up over a million views within 48 hours. The media ran stories about it within days. In a few weeks, everyone forgot about it. These things used to have longer legs.
Daddy bit me.
Back in 2008, this video of a tiny British boy sticking his fingers in his baby brother's mouth got passed around for months and months and months and months. YouTube's trends manager, Kevin Alaka, says it's hard to imagine its popularity lasting so long today.
That stuff definitely still exists, but a lot of the most popular things that we're seeing now are starting to come from professionals at producing, you know, creativity and entertainment.
And this year, videos dropped in and out of our consciousness faster.
The speed with which these things happen just doesn't cease to amaze me.
This guy's job is to track how things get popular on YouTube, and he's amazed. He says in 2012, it was not just jokey stuff capturing our momentary attention.
My brother tried to escape.
A video about the Central African warlord, Joseph Kony, started showing up last March on Facebook and Twitter. It took only a few days for Kony 2012 to obliterate previous YouTube records, 30 million views a day. But the backlash came faster, too. Between criticism and controversy, Kony 2012 basically vanished from the cultural conversation within a month. Kevin Alaka.
Really made me think about the velocity with which we're operating right now and the pace of popularity for some of these videos.
Not just videos over the past year either. A couple of years ago, there were 32 million people playing Farmville on Facebook. They happily sent each other online cabbages and watered each other's crops. It took 2 years for the vast majority of players to lose interest. When this year's version of Farmville came out, it took only 3 months for the number of players to fall from a high of 7 million to around 2. Accelerating the pace of linking and poking might actually be an efficient way to be a human, says sociologist Marco Gonzalez.
That is how to be a more social person in today's world.
We are intensely social animals, hardwired to get pleasure from connecting online.
We're actually looking to be more social than ever before. Maybe to the point of a problem, right?
Maybe. Remember Binders Full of Women? Or the Olympic gymnast Michaela Maroney scowling on the podium with her medal? It's hard to keep up with the cultural conversation.
People cry and moan a lot about the decreasing attention span of America and America's youth.
Shayna Naomi Crockmall is a digital producer for Current TV.
I think everyone's attention span in America is at the best quartered from where it was even 5 years ago. I think absolutely.
Call it the quartering of the half-life. Crockmall thinks it's partly because of the strain on old media in a 24-hour news cycle. Memes are cool. They're plucked up, chewed on, spat out, and forgotten.
I think the kind of media we have now does really reward that intense, instant, obsessive focus. But how long can you do that for, right?
Not so long in a burgeoning online universe. This year, Facebook topped 1 billion users. More of us from all over the world are using the same social media, using it better and faster, and that means ever more information to pass around. Of course, some of it will not go away.
Open Gangnam Style.
Things tend to stick around if they're interactive. Something people can copy or remix. Social media used to be limited to computers. This was the year over 50% of American consumers had smartphones. So we have Twitter and Facebook in our pockets.
Andy Borowitz is a comedian who's worked successfully in old and new media.
Our access to the internet has just improved so dramatically over the last few years. We didn't have as much high-speed Wi-Fi 5 years ago as we have today. We didn't have high-speed networks on our phones the way we have them now.
Borowitz says personally, he's exhausted by the rapid-fire fire hose of information he gets on Twitter and Facebook. So this year, he's trying to read more books. It's balm, he says, for his overstimulated brain. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
And 2012 was the year that music streaming services sought to make physical ownership of a CD or even a song file passé. Both Spotify and Pandora launched major efforts to lure new customers, but they found their business model can be challenging, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports in today's Business Bottom Line.
There are two types of people music streaming services have been trying to win over in the U.S. There is the younger generation, like 19-year-old Kayleen Fong.
Do you ever buy music?
No.
Like a lot of young people, when Fong wants to hear a song, she listens for free on YouTube. In fact, she doesn't even think about it as a video site. Here's her definition.
It's a search engine where you type in my favorite artist, which is the Hollies. They have a video of them, and they usually have interviews. Bus stop, wet day, she's there.
Fong's taste in music may date back to the days before she was born, but her way of getting it is totally au courant. A study this year by Nielsen found that YouTube is the most popular way for teens and young adults to listen to and discover music. Streaming services also have to lure an audience on the other end of the age spectrum.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Taylor, and I am a dinosaur.
Taylor is a filmmaker in her 40s who still buys stuff. More than 1,000 CDs and hundreds of LPs crowd her San Francisco apartment. She pulls out an album by Brazilian singer Tete Espíndola.
I remember buying this. I remember, you know, going to a record store in Brazil. I used to take these trips to South America with empty tote bags and minimal clothes so I could come back with tote bags full of 12-inch vinyl records that there'd be no way I could find elsewhere.
As different as she is from 19-year-old Fong, Taylor presents streaming services with the same basic problem. How do you get consumers to pay a monthly fee for something when they won't actually own it? And they can probably find it for free somewhere online. The two major streaming services, Spotify and Pandora, have been trying to lure these people into paying by offering free versions supported with ads. Mike McGuire is an analyst with Gartner.
You have to have some version of the free or the radio extreme experience so you can get people into the system. Then how do you get them to cross over to become paying subscribers?
So far, Spotify has only managed to get about a quarter of its 20 million users to pay $10 a month, but it still is not profitable. Its main competitor, Pandora, which has 175 million users, has had several quarters of profitability, but it's had to put the money back into growing the service. And the more users the two streaming services get, the more royalties they have to pay to artists and labels, even if those users aren't paying for a subscription. This year, Pandora launched a lobbying effort to get Congress to lower the royalty rates.
Because that's kind of their big existential threat, right, is if those rates go way up, it's going to be even harder for them to generate profit.
McGuire says even if Pandora were to succeed in changing royalty rates, there is still a question of whether these streaming services can hold on until music listening habits change.
We're in this period of transition where it's not going to be a simple cutoff transition where, you know, at some point, you know, X percent of the consumer base all of a sudden flops over to streaming. It's going to be a progression, probably a relatively slow one.
Music fan Jennifer Taylor was actually surprised by what she found when she began investigating on Spotify. She was convinced it wouldn't have all the artists she loves, like that Brazilian singer. So we searched.
Oh, my God.
So she's there.
Okay, she's there.
Taylor isn't planning to become a subscriber to Spotify anytime soon, but the pressure to move over to streaming services is growing. Many computer makers are no longer installing a CD-DVD drive, and rumor has it that this coming year, Apple is going to launch its own streaming music service. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
One of the biggest topics of the year on Twitter has been television. People have been watching TV with their laptops and phones in hand for a while now. It's called the two-screen experience. TV is the first screen, and the social media of your choice is on your second screen. 2012 was the year businesses spent a lot of time and money trying to capitalize on the relationship between the two screens, as NPR's Sammy Yenigun reports.
Once upon a time, there was one screen that TV broadcasters needed to fill.
That's all? These were the good old days.
These days, things just ain't the same.
Now, if you have a question for Antonio, all you have to do is check out our Facebook page, NFL on ESPN.
Using our friends to analyze thousands and thousands of tweets in the Twitterverse.
Just log on to BravoTV.com/playlive with your smartphone or tablet.
It's the age of the second screen. In 2012, big business tried harder than ever to bring television to tablets and phones.
This year, I think we've seen a maturity in the social television space, which is still very nascent.
That's Mark Ganim from Trender TV. They keep track of social media around television.
You know, just looking at this year versus last year, there's been, an 800% growth in the commentary around TV real time.
Did you catch that? The TV show Chit Chat on social media was 8 times louder this year than in 2011. According to Nielsen, roughly 40% of people who own tablets and smartphones watch TV with them every day. People like Roxane Gay.
I find television and pop culture in general to be kind of absurd. And Twitter is a really convenient medium for sharing the ridiculous thoughts that I have while watching ridiculous things.
And as more and more people join Gay in her conversation, more and more brands are pushing towards the second screen. Take a show like Survivor. On the side of the screen, there's a pound sign and a word.
They have a hashtag for something like immunity challenge.
Once again, immunity is back up for grabs.
So that you can see other people talking about it. And so television shows, I think, are realizing that people are starting to consume television differently.
Every tweet with that pound signed immunity challenge will fall into one searchable feed. So when CBS places a hashtag on screen number one, they're essentially creating a chat room on screen number two. And online chatter is just one of the things that second screens are used for. Trender's Mark Ganim says people also want to learn about what they're watching.
Picture, you know, a fantasy football league while you're watching your game, or data around sports as it's happening.
There's also reward-based apps where viewers get social cred for checking into shows.
Like GetGlue, where you get stickers for checking in, and Viggle, where you earn points that can add up to value cards and things like that.
Add to that gaming experiences, shopping experiences, and direct interaction with the show itself. This past year, a technology called Automatic Content Recognition, or ACR, synced up screens like never before.
Start your enhanced Next Iron Chef redemption experience now. Sync the Into Now app to your TV from your tablet or smartphone.
Starting in November, the Food Network and Yahoo introduced the Next Iron Chef Into Now app. It automatically links TV and tablet.
It is, you know, I guess, the best of the best of a second screen experience.
That's Susie Fogelson, Senior Vice President of Marketing for the Food Network. She explains how this works. Let's say Chef Alex Garnaschelli is in a cook-off.
Say she makes a frittata and she doesn't know whether that was the right use of egg or not. And then literally right after that kind of final decision, you will see a video that is really exclusive to the app that talks about whether that was a good decision or not.
That's interesting. All right.
For businesses, there are a ton of upsides. Trender's Mark Ganim says once brands have grabbed someone's attention with the TV, they can use the second screen to keep them locked in.
You could have a 30-second commercial that is triggering a 7-minute experience with a brand.
Find us on the web at MediaManagementPros.com or talk to us on Facebook and Twitter.
If that call to action or handoff is meaningful, the user will explore it.
And once the TV watcher starts watching their phone instead, who's to say that they're looking at screen number two?
The dominant screen might be for you talking to your friends around the show, right? Versus the other way around.
Next year, the Nielsen Twitter TV rating will track the buzz around television. Sammy Yenigun, NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
All
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, are you invited to any parties for Kwanzaa, which is going on now? If the answer is yes, you're not alone. If the answer is no, you're not alone either. We'll ask just how widely observed is this Inspired by Africa Made in America celebration. But first, the familiar ping of a new tweet. Many of you might have heard that this year's top tweet was a photo of President Obama embracing the First Lady with the words, "Four more years." The Obama campaign tweet became the most popular tweet in history. We decided we wanted to take a look at some of the other Twitter trends that got the attention of the Twitterati this year. Joining us now are two avid tweeters. Kelly Goff is a political correspondent for TheRoot.com. That is an online publication that focuses on news from diverse African-American perspectives. Also with us, Viviana Hurtado. She's blogger-in-chief of the website The Wise Latina Club. Welcome back to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Great to
tweet,
be back.
Tweet, Michelle. Hi.
Before we get started, I just wanted to ask each of you. You both have roots in traditional communication forms. Kelly, you authored a well-respected book about politics. Viviana, you hold a doctorate and you were a network correspondent. When you first got involved with Twitter, did you envision it as being as central to your professional lives as it has become? And why do you think that is? Viviana, why don't you start?
I know that Twitter was a pain when I signed up. I think Twitter was one of those things where I ended up copying and pasting my Facebook messages. And I've ended up really embracing Twitter because it is this incredible forum to magnify your voice. And on Twitter, on social media in general, but Twitter in particular, Latinos are just booming. We have embraced social media, Twitter in particular, and we're having discussions. We're talking amongst ourselves. We're hearing our perspectives where we don't oftentimes hear them or see them in other contexts.
Kelly, what about you?
I was dragged kicking and screaming to Twitter, and that's putting it mildly. And of course, now I'm thrilled to be there. And I will say that what finally kind of convinced me of its relevance is that a couple of major stories broke, if you remember, a couple years ago on Twitter. I can't remember the exact tweet, but if you remember correctly, Newt Gingrich said something during the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings that was really controversial, and it really sparked that whole great conversation about wise Latinas, diversity, what those of us who are people of color, how we see the world and live the world differently from someone who is part of the predominant hegemonic culture. That did it. And also, if you remember, Sarah Palin went through a bit of a news blackout where she wasn't really talking to traditional news outlets. And if you wanted to hear Sarah Palin's voice, you kind of had to follow her on Facebook and Twitter. And that was sort of convinced me that we were in a whole brand new world and that you needed Twitter if you want to be part of the conversation and actually follow the news.
Interesting. Makes sense. But do you ever tweet hegemonic? That's the question I have. Anyway, so two of the top tweets, Kelly, you wrote about this for The Root, and you started with your tweet from March of 2012 from Fox News personality Geraldo Rivera.
You know, it sparked such a conversation in a way that I really don't know that we would have had it without that tweet, which is during the height of the Trayvon Martin coverage, the tragedy of the unarmed black teen who was shot by George Zimmerman, Geraldo Rivera tweeted something to the effect of, "Trayvon Martin's hoodie is just as much to blame for this." And we all know the fallout, but it bears revisiting, which is a huge conversation about racial profiling was sparked in a way I don't think people outside of minority communities would have been engaged had that tweet not sparked a conversation, right? Because often racial profiling, Michelle, gets bogged down into just race, where people say, "I don't think black people get treated differently in a store." The real question is what he brought up, right? Does the rich white kid of an executive who happens to be wearing a hoodie because he thinks it looks cool while he goes shopping in Bergdorf's get treated the same way as the poor black kid who's also wearing the hoodie because he thinks it looks cool? And that's what his conversation sparked. It also sparked a movement of a number of people wearing hoodies in solidarity, a lot of celebrities such as LeBron James, many, many others. And I actually ended up wearing one on air when I discussed this on air in solidarity as well about the story.
Viviana, what about one of the Twitter trends that was most important to you this year was about the death of superstar Jenny Rivera and also the sports star Hector Camacho.
Hector, El Macho Camacho.
El Macho and, Camacho. Yes.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about this is Jenny Rivera's death and El Macho Camacho's death were huge, but it was really what was going on. The tweet that caught my eye was tweeted by Jorge Ramos, who wrote something along the lines of, in his tweet, that the wall-to-wall Spanish language coverage, the mainstream media just misses that. And that's why their ratings are down the tubes. And what he meant by that, and it's interesting that Jenny Rivera's funeral was carried live on Univision, you have to understand Univision sometimes doesn't carry State of the Union live.
But you haven't persuaded me that Twitter is the reason that those figures were covered as they were.
It's magnified.
Yeah.
There's conversations happening on Twitter that aren't happening elsewhere for the mainstream. And then where they're happening on Twitter, it's being magnified. But here's the problem. Twitter is a great place for me to magnify my voice. But is anyone who could make decisions and include my voice listening?
Kelly, what about that? You had another top tweet for 2012 that was important to you. It was about the whole question of the role of women and how that played out during the campaign.
Yeah, when Hillary Rosen, Democratic strategist, made what frankly was actually an accurate statement about Ann Romney, which I did say in a column, even though Hillary got in a lot of trouble for it, she said, you know, this woman has never worked a day in her life. As I said, if she literally added dot, dot, dot outside of the home, there would have never been a kerfluffle. She didn't add that, so there was a kerfluffle. And it sparked a lot of controversy that really could have proved problematic, particularly in a presidential campaign, right, where we know women voters were really going to be decisive. So what was interesting is everyone, I think, was waiting to see whether or not this was going to be proved to be a pivotal turning point in the campaign, depending on how the Obama campaign responded. And I actually think they kind of surprised everyone, not the campaign technically, but Michelle Obama, who was relatively new to Twitter, had not tweeted that much, responded with, "All mothers work and all women deserve respect." And there wasn't really a lot to say on the conservative end in response to blaming the Obamas for anything. This really became about one strategist.
You know, the other interesting thing about it, each of you said that you were kind of dragged to Twitter kicking and screaming. And my guess is partly because you were worried that it would be too time consuming and it would just be another thing that you had to add to your day. What I'm kind of hearing both of you say is it's become a very efficient way to start conversations and sometimes, Kelly, as you were saying, to end conversations. Viviana?
And receive information.
Well, and actually, I would add that actually the most widely read story I've ever done in my career, which I still find this surprising, but, you know, I wrote a column about the revelation, if you can call it that, that Paul Ryan, the vice presidential pick's college sweetheart, was African-American. I got that story because I happened, I guess, to be the only person who saw the tweet from another reporter who said Paul Ryan mentioned in an article that his college sweetheart was African-American. And that's how I actually got that story. So it's turned out to be much more efficient, let's say, than I ever thought it would be.
But apart from that, Viviana, your final thought here is sometimes just fun. And one of the other tweet trends that you wanted to highlight for us is the fictional Spanglish-speaking mayor of New York City, El Blumbito. And there's actually the voice behind El Blumbito is not the person you might expect.
No. Well, he has a PhD in speaky the Spanishy. And El Blumbito is just this alter ego of Mayor Bloomberg, who speaky the Spanish during these press conferences. And what G. Eurekan, a.k.a. Rachel Figueroa Levin, has done is just she tweets out these fictional tweets. You know, for example, during the hurricane, he would say, a tweet would say something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing, "Be careful, Lo, in Central Parko, because you walk under a trio y esplato." it's just funny. It's fresh. And, you know, you'd think that during, for example, Hurricane Sandy, which was serious and a lot of people are still without homes, that it might not be taken well. I think that G. Eurekan, a.k.a. El Blumbito, has done an amazing job of capturing what's behind Mayor Bloomberg's, I guess, intents to speak Spanish, and she's done it in a really comical way.
Well, how can we say happy nuevo año, Viviana?
Well, muchos gracias, Michelle.
And I'm just going to say adios. That's the extent of my contribution.
Viviana Hurtado is blogger-in-chief at the website The Wise Latina Club. She joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. With us from New York was TheRoot.com's Kelly Goff. Ladies, thank you so much. And as we said, Feliz Nuevo Año. Would that be the right?
Happy Año,
happy Año Nuevo to you.
Yes. Happy holidays, everyone.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Almost every Monday, we ask NPR's Steve Henn or Laura Seidel to tell us about the week ahead
in tech news. Well, today we're going for broke. As we say goodbye to 2012, we thought we'd take a look ahead a bit further into the new year. Steve and Laura both join us now to give their best guesses as to what's in store for us in 2013. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
And Laura, let's start with you. What do you think? Is this the year we finally get jetpacks?
Yes, we're going to get jetpacks, and they're going to be traffic jams over Manhattan. No, alas, not yet. We are likely to get new game consoles this year from both Sony and Microsoft. And what you're likely to see is, as always, you're going to have better graphics and very likely 3D, at least from Sony, probably from both of them. So gamers have that to be excited about. But you're also going to see, I think, a continuation of the trend of turning these devices into more than just game consoles, but into something that's really a home entertainment center. And word on the street is that particularly Microsoft is going to go for this. So you might have a game console that wirelessly connects to every screen in your house. So you could have somebody playing a game in one room and watching television through the game console in another room. And so it really will be this central device in your house.
Very exciting. Now, we've been hearing a lot about 3D printing lately. Do you think that'll come to play a bigger role in the consumer market?
Yes. The price of 3D printers has come down significantly. And for those who aren't exactly sure what it is, it basically takes material. It could be a metal, whatever. It melts it down, and then it prints it into a 3D object. So you might be able to print out your own jewelry or toys. So I think this is the year you're really going to see that. And I think that's going to be an exciting trend for people, especially if you're creative.
And finally, speaking of trends, Laura, tablets have caught on with consumers, but in terms of sales, they still are in the shadow of the laptop. Does that change next year? Does the tablet overtake the laptop?
I think it changes big time. As we know, Apple introduced this back in 2010, and tablets have taken off. The prices come down. You've got Google, you've got Amazon, and in a lot of ways, you can work on these devices now. So I think people will think, do I want a laptop, or am I going to spend $200 on a Google Nexus, say? And I think people may very often go for the tablet. And I think this year they will actually overtake the laptops and sales. And lastly, speaking of Apple, I want to say a lot of people believe Apple is going to release a streaming music service this year, and that's going to be big. That will add to the landscape of Pandora and Spotify.
Well, on to Steve Henn. Steve, I hear that you also have some predictions for the coming year, including the price tags of some of those devices Laura just mentioned, smartphones, tablets.
Yeah, I think that smartphones and tablets prices will continue to come down. That's a trend that we've seen for a long time. But I think what that means is that some of the most interesting technology trends will actually take place in the developing world. Right now, the vast majority of phones that are sold in developing countries are feature phones. But as that begins to change, as the price of smartphones comes down, we're going to see first millions and then billions of people connecting to the internet through these smartphones. And really what that gives them access to for the first time is supercomputing in their pocket. You know, I think that obviously this trend won't happen all at once and it won't happen all next year. But as it accelerates, I think it will transform economics in these regions, politics, in really profound ways. So that's one thing I'm going to be watching next year.
And what about the good old-fashioned PC? Where is it left in all this?
Well, I think the bigger, older mainline PC manufacturers, especially ones with roots in the United States, will continue to struggle mightily. You know, in 2011, HP abandoned its own smartphone platform. Just a few weeks ago, Dell announced it was getting out of the smartphone business. And I think really that these companies, by doing that, have cut themselves off from a huge part of where growth in computing is going to take place in the next few years, in these lighter, cheaper devices and in developing markets around the world.
Well, if the PC is a kind of dinosaur at this point, tell us about some new evolving life form that we haven't seen yet.
Well, I think one of the new life forms will be in the emergence of devices that we didn't previously think of as computers, having really sophisticated computing and connectivity embedded in them. So we're already seeing things like that with Google Glass. These are these augmented reality glasses that Google will start selling next year that will project data about your environment on lenses just a few inches from your eyes. I think we're going to see much more of that. I think we're going to see connectivity and computing embedded in more cars, glasses, obviously, watches, and thermostats. But I think what's going to distinguish these products isn't going to be sort of their design aesthetics, but the idea that artificial intelligence will drive them to give users really contextually relevant information when they need it. So I think in the future, maybe even next year, you're going to come to expect your smartphone to warn you if there is a traffic jam coming. And if you're choosing between digital wallets that are built into your mobile phone, you're going to choose the one that offers you really smart financial advice. That trend I sort of think of as big data for little people. And that's the final trend I'm watching this year.
Well, Steve Henn and Laura Seidel, it sounds like an interesting year ahead. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Our pleasure.
Here's a motley crew for you. Newsman Dan Rather, rapper Snoop Dogg, or is it Snoop Lion, actress Molly Ringwald, public radio host Ira Glass, and President Obama. All right, what do they all have in common? They all hosted question and answer sessions on Reddit this year, a link-sharing website that's become one of the most popular social media communities online. This month, the site reported more than 3.5 billion page views. To tell us more about why it's been a big year for Reddit, Anthony DeRosa is here. He's the social media editor for Reuters. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, how are you, Adi?
So Reddit is best known as a link-sharing site where users essentially vote up or down if they like something, they rank it, and the most popular links make it to the top. And all those celebrities we mentioned, they all participated in a part of the site called Ask Me Anything. And tell us more about how it works.
So Ask Me Anything is sort of an interview that's conducted on Reddit. A thread is started by the person who wants to be interviewed, and people post questions in that thread. At first, it was just regular people. It could be a plumber. It could be someone who works at a factory. But it's really been incredible, the level of celebrity that they're attracting now to do these Ask Me Anythings. That's where it starts to get really interesting, because you often don't have that one-to-one connection with these people. And people are very unguarded. I think Obama answered some provocative questions. So it's really interesting to watch people's reaction to them.
Right. People asked him about how he balanced his work life and family life. They also asked him about marijuana laws.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was some questions about indefinite detention, about drones. Those he obviously kind of steered away from. But, you know, you could go to those threads and see the questions that were asked. And sometimes the questions that are unanswered are as interesting as the ones that are.
One thing about Reddit is it's really a mixed bag of information. I'm looking at the site right now, and there's a post that says, how do I tell my wife she has a mustache? There's another post where someone says they're a World War II veteran. Ask them anything. And we also heard about forums on the site this year for rape jokes and explicit photos of underage girls. I mean, what are the limits that Reddit imposes on its users, if any?
Yeah, before some of these things came up this year, the site was pretty much the Wild West. People were posting everything and anything on the site. And they're now starting to think about the governance of the site, consider how they decide what content can be on there, what cannot. So there's sort of an evolution of the way that the site is run that's taking place now.
Who is the audience? I mean, we talked about this enormous number, more than 3.5 billion page views, but who's the intended audience for Reddit? Who flocks to the site?
Well, the site, if you look at some of the services that rank these websites, have them anywhere in the top 140 websites in the world. In the U.S., they're around the top 40. The demographics kind of skew towards young white males, fairly affluent, college-educated. It doesn't have a very wide demographic. It kind of tends towards the real geek underbelly of the internet.
But at the same time, it sounds like this group is very influential in terms of pushing content that might end up on other websites. And could that be why politicians, for instance, would want to tap into it?
Certainly. The Reddit is sort of known as the front page of the internet. Every site on the internet usually goes to Reddit to find out what's going on. And oftentimes you'll find that the content that you see on other blogs comes from Reddit. They'll go to Reddit and they'll either take stuff wholesale from Reddit, or they'll take a spin on what Reddit is reporting, or take bits and pieces of it and rewrite it. But Reddit is very much kind of a resource for bloggers and even mainstream writers who are looking for something to write about.
It's interesting you mentioned that motto, the front page of the internet, because Reddit has also played a role in some breaking news situations this past year as well.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, there was real-time updates about the shooting, both in Aurora and the one that had taken place at Sandy Hook. People were posting information coming from people directly on the scene who were tweeting it out, posting it on Facebook. So we're seeing Reddit starting to become more of a real-time news resource as well.
Anthony, any ideas about what's next for Reddit in 2013?
I think now it's really starting to go into the mainstream. Hopefully the demographics are beginning to change. There's going to be people from different walks of life and different backgrounds. And that's when it really starts to get interesting, because those people will find ways to leverage Reddit and the community there. And topics that haven't been broached up until this point will start to be discussed. And I think you'll continue to see Reddit used in ways that may not have even occurred to us.
Anthony DeRosa, he's the social media editor for Reuters. Anthony, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.